This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is the Hidden Killers Podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Brian Koberger.
He stalked them for months. He turned off his phone. He left behind just one thing, a knife sheath with DNA. The evidence, obviously, it is now public. The gag order is gone. And today we're breaking it all down with someone who knows exactly what those investigative steps look like on the inside. She's tracked killers, she's interrogated violent offenders, and she's here to walk us through how this case was built and what it tells us about Brian Koberger's mind. We're going to dig into this with FBI Special Agent retired Jennifer Coffendaffer as we pull back the curtain on Brian Koberger. And in this first area, now that we know that he surveilled them for all this time, Jennifer, the house over 20 times, studied criminology, and left almost no physical trace beyond the knife sheath, what does it tell us about him from a behavioral perspective when it comes to trying to pull off this crime and what he did and what he did not do?
Well, you know, Tony, what this really tells us is about how well orchestrated this was, how well planned this was, how well thought out, and how educated he was. Obviously, a PhD student, he has had so many criminal justice classes at some of the, you know, finest criminal justice programs at DeSales, and then also at Washington State University, which I think very much helped him in understanding what he needed to do to make sure he could pull off a crime. As you mentioned, the knife sheath was left behind. And then other than that, we have his footprint as well. That he left that was later found through an amino acid technique that's often used to bring up any blood or trace evidence regarding shoe prints and things. So, but other than that, you're exactly right. It showed that he was knowledgeable and he was committed to pulling off the perfect crime.
It shows that, I mean, obviously there was likely some obsession here that was going on for quite a bit of time leading up into this case. I think now we're all trying to figure out, okay, how long was this obsession? What kind of pre-planning was going on? And there's little drips of information that continue to come out. A lot of freedom of information requests have been put out. And in fact, the powers that be are slowly putting the pieces out there for us to see and to be revealed as to what they were looking at all this time. Some other pieces have continued to come out in various pieces of reporting. I was getting into the James Patterson and Vicki Ward book over the last week when I was gone in the airports. It's called The Idaho Four. There's some new reporting in there. Talking about the surveilling that he allegedly did outside of those homes, being able to look in those windows, very detailed accounts of what you could see through those windows. And when we now are starting to look at the vehicle data and new pieces that are coming out, it is theorized that Koberger was sitting there, not with a boombox outside of the window playing Peter Gabriel on it, but in a creepy white Hyundai Elantra, staring at a girl who was living her life, putting makeup on and off, getting ready for her day, getting ready for bed. That's an interesting thought to think that he's out there doing that.
Yeah, Tony, he learned this, in my belief, is really through what BTK did. This was exactly the modus operandi of BTK. And I'm not saying that from the standpoint of the type of serial killer I believe he was, doesn't match up necessarily to BTK, but how he conducted his business and surveillance exactly lined up. I teach in my classes all the time, if you are a young woman or a young man and you live by yourself, no one else is there, you have to change up your routine. Turn on different lights when you come in, exit from different ways, do different patterns to your school or your work. Don't make everything the same, because they absolutely hone in on that and follow what you're doing so that they can know where you're at in that house and when you're there.
And that's a scary thing about characters like this, is they can sit there out in the silence, and had he never acted, no one would be the wiser. There would have just been this creepy guy that he knew. He has the memories of sitting out there and staring into this window and allegedly watching Maddie Mogan get ready and you know, live her life as a young, beautiful college girl, just kind of starting out. The fact that someone like this has no prior violent criminal record, is it odd that then escalated directly to this brutal four-person homicide, or is there more to Brian's story that just isn't on the record that we're going to slowly learn about? I'm not saying necessarily out murdering other people, although there are questions, but more so this sort of stalking-ish behavior, this sort of just in the shadows, I'm there, you don't know about me, but if you did find me out, what I'd be doing would likely be borderline, at least criminal behavior in some way, shape, or form.
Right. I think that it would be very interesting to see all his movements, not just to 1122 King Road area, but were there any other areas, either when he lived in Pennsylvania, when he lived in Idaho, any other possible targets that he just decided not to go for? Mm-hmm. In other words, would we see the same pattern in another neighborhood nearby or any place in mm-hmm. Pennsylvania before he moved to Idaho? I would be very interested to see all of that because I would be surprised if this was just the first go around. Certainly, I've always said I think it's the first go around pertaining to murder, mm-hmm. But not burglary. I mean, I've always thought he could have possibly even dabbled in going in a house mm-hmm. of somebody that yeah. he was interested in when they weren't there. So I think that there's a lot out there. But to your question, did he particularly target these people, and did he do anything else in the past? Again, I think it was limited to these surveillance moves.
We are learning some new things. Some new allegations are out in that book, The Idaho Four, from James Patterson, from a family friend. And I don't have their name on top of me at this moment in time, but a family friend, it was a young child that he grew up with, and the mom that the parents realized that every time Brian would come over, things would go missing. There was some very expensive things that went missing in that home. And this was back during Koberger's heroin days. The allegation is that he was taking these things. It was around the same time he stole his sister's phone and then went and tried to he did sell it at the mall kiosk for money. His dad turns him in. He gets in trouble. The family friend also makes allegations in the book that Koberger was stealing directly from them on times where he could sneak something out of the house and nobody would get caught. It was only after he was going through the 12 steps in rehab that he came back to say, I'm sorry for stealing from you. He had a very large history of stealthy, creepy behavior that went under the radar for years. I'm just wondering how that then manifested from, you know, stealing an iPhone or an iPad to someone, your friend's mom's jewelry, to let's go kill four people.
Well, you know, when you look at the motivation for those crimes, I believe it truly was money motivated to support his heroin addict mm-hmm. or addiction. But this is what's unique about it. Look at who he targeted. People who he should love, mm-hmm. his sister, friends, family. In other words, just again showing the lack of empathy on his part, the fact that he didn't care who he hurt and how close to them he was. So many people who become addicts and need money, they focus on strangers. Mm-hmm. They go into their homes and take and steal because they don't want to hurt the people they're closest to necessarily, because they have that empathy. To me, it just reiterates what we know, what he's personally said in his writings mm-hmm. and what he has shown. And that is, he just doesn't care about anyone.
Is that a sign when you're an investigator that maybe you're on the right path, when you take a look at someone and they have a pattern of basically victimizing people very close to them that they supposedly love, that they still are engaging in regular personal relationships with, but have a record of hurting them with seemingly no empathy and no no regret whatsoever that maybe this person is capable of far worse if they're capable of that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you look at that from a victimology standpoint. You look at that from trying to figure out who is sitting across the desk from you or who you are investigating as to whether they could have committed this crime. Tony, when you see people victimizing the people that they're closest to, you know you're dealing with a different animal than the ones that victimize outside their inner circle.
Do people like that? I mean, it feels to me, I mean, from watching a lot on this subject and studying the history of some of these folks, These seem like the type that are not going to change. This seems to be kind of embedded DNA when you watch or listen to Koberger speak or you've looked at some of his earlier writings and such. This is the animal. This is who he is. It doesn't seem like this is something that's going to be trained out of him or something that does he even recognize that there's something wrong at this point? Clearly, he seemed to a long time ago, but I'm wondering at this point, does he? Is he made peace with himself?
Oh, I think he recognizes it, and I think he doesn't care. I think he crossed the bridge where he learned to embrace his deepest, darkest wishes and desires. You know, what came out in the through source information on the Dateline special was very interesting about how the pornography he liked, you know, the pornography of young women who were asleep, who were drugged, so much in line with Ted Bundy. You know, the necrophiliac sort, the type that wanted a victim that absolutely could not respond to anything. Same with Dahmer. Dahmer, a similar type of the victim that they wanted to attack. It's really gross, and certainly he knew how dark he was, I think.
What I'm wondering about with him, and this is just conjecture, is was he naturally that dark of a person? Was he someone who gravitated toward looking up that sort of dark pornography? Someone who gravitated toward the dark idea of killing people in the way that he did? Or was this another extension of learned behavior? Because he had such trouble identifying who he was and what he was. And then he started studying these horrible minds like Ted Bundy and BTK and such. And did he just go, well, I can learn that too. And took on, because it almost feels like he took on the persona of other killers to make the killer that he is today. But I suppose you could look at those killers too, and everybody gets inspiration somewhere.
Well, I think when you look at him, and I agree on the inspiration, I think he looked on at a lot of different avenues, studied a lot of different serial killers. We know that because of all the classes he took and took under Ramsland and other classes that he took. But I truly believe it's like being a pedophile. No one just wakes up and becomes a pedophile later. They become a pedophile, I think, because of something deep and dark that's within them that sexually arouses them. And at the end of the day, the biggest thing I think to denote is this was a sexually motivated crime that he did. Did he get to act out? No, because Kaylee was in bed with Maddie and it surprised him. And Xana was up. And all the things that just went wrong in the visualization of what he thought was going to happen that night, it all turned south for him. But this was sexually motivated, Tony, and this is something that I believe you're born with, so to speak. Some, you know, desire like that. Either you have it or you don't.
Yeah, some sort of horrible primal something that exists in certain people. Let's talk about the investigation a bit. This is an interesting one. This is one where they didn't sit down and question him. What do you know about this? It was an immediate arrest. Once they knew at least who they thought was their guy early on, they came in and broke the door down at his parents' house in Pennsylvania. In a case like this, how rare is it to see a case to be this tight without ever interviewing the suspect, without ever having any sort of, you know, conversation with mom or dad or people next to him before they go in and make that arrest? That must show that they were very, very confident from the start that this is their guy.
Yeah. You know, when you have a case like this, first of all, you can imagine the fright that gripped Moscow, even though early on the messaging was, no, there nobody needs to be worried mm-hmm. about this. This is just a targeted event, right? Mm-hmm. And then slowly the truth really came out. And I think they just, their messaging was so horrible. As many of us said, listen, you have somebody capable of killing four people out there. This community is definitely not safe. And certainly the FBI knew that and law mm-hmm. enforcement knew that. And so the full court press and the ability of them to really put this case together with a approximate 20-page probable cause affidavit, which was just part of the evidence they had. They went in there strong. Remember, too, they received very special from the judge. They received the special ability to go in even before the normal hours of a hit, what we call a hit, right? At mm-hmm. 6 a.m., they went in before that. And this is very rare. And it shows that they very specifically were so concerned that if they didn't have surprise and speed and violence of action, that, in other words, they couldn't call him out. They didn't want to go out when he was awake and could perceive them. He could take hostages. He could kill his parents. He could kill himself and his parents. I mean, there were so many terrible scenarios when everybody really looks badly and says, why was this a huge SWAT operation? Well, that's why, Tony. Mm-hmm. They needed to get in and on him quick. They did try to interview him. And initially, he started interviewing with them. And then he shut it down and asked for an attorney.
Really?
Yes. Yep. Right away, they tried to interview him. And there were... there was a spontaneous utterance made immediately upon arrest where he said yes. words to the effect, did you arrest anyone else?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's been huge speculation. Mm-hmm. Remember early on, everybody thought, oh, there's a co-conspirator. Some people thought, no, that's a ruse. Bundy had done a similar ruse. Mm-hmm. And then I really thought he was worried about his parents, mm-hmm. like harboring him. That's kind of what I lean toward. But I think any of those, the latter two could be possible. Also him, you know, throwing out the ruse. But I really thought he might've been concerned about his parents, the fact they could that be harboring. But yeah, they did a very short interview and then before he invoked his rights.
One thing I wonder about with that, as we now look back on everything, and now we're going to see more that the gag order has been lifted, is did Koberger try to steer the investigation anywhere else? Obviously, they only have the knife sheet there as far as his DNA on it, and now we're learning more about that footprint. But other than that, there wasn't a lot to go on from the beginning. And the fact that he's asking, was there anyone else, it does make you wonder a little bit. Did he have the foresight in this to try and point them in another direction? Obviously, he was trying to do that a bit. If, in fact, that was Papa Roger on Facebook that was saying, oh, the Honda might be a red herring. was that a little too late to the game to try and steer the ship? Or I wonder if there was other things that were there that I don't want to say were missed, but were picked up and the investigator said, yeah, that's not evidence. That's somebody that's trying to steer us somewhere else.
Well, the Papa Roger, right? I mean, certainly if that was him, he was trying to lead and brag and be grandiose and, just like BTK did. Mm-hmm. And just like many others have been done, Zodiac and many others, they love to be able to taunt mm-hmm. and to just revel in what they've done, only not been caught for. The Papa Roger always made a lot of sense to me, but we'll see. You know, still, we don't really have that answer. I think we're going to get the answer. I don't think that's something that they would withhold the metadata concerning the IP address for that. At one point, I know that source reporting from within side, you know, was that definitely it was Papa. But since then, there's been other... Mm-hmm. Posts that have come out that many sleuths have said, see, this is Papa again. I don't know. We're going to find out. whether he was Paco or not.
I don't know how it couldn't be. I don't see how it couldn't be, or I guess someone communicating with him. That's the only other thing I could possibly think of, which I think that's a whole other road that there's no evidence really to go down, but how else would you have a caricature of yourself that looks pretty much exactly like you putting out information that nobody knows and nobody knows what you look like at the time? That just, I don't know. It just seems to defy any sort of logic, that it could have been anyone other than Koberger. But at the end of the day, it still plays into the pattern of behavior, whereas BTK was trying to put letters out into the Wichita Eagle through a floppy disk. He's doing the more modern thing and putting it out there on social media. Are you surprised that the criminology students, you know, in 2022 was too stupid to realize that there's IP addresses and that these sort of things can be tracked, which I'm sure is probably already been done by now, just not publicly released as of yet?
Well, you know, am I surprised? No, I just think he thought he would never get caught. You know, there's always this delusion of grandeur that these criminals have. Mm-hmm. They really do believe they're the smartest guy in the room and that they have their tracks covered and that nobody's going to catch them. But, you know, he put out two odd posts also, mm-hmm. One to do with, as I recall, an election and another school board election, I think it was, and another one. I actually contacted the people. I went down this rabbit trail, every single post he made, and I actually ended up getting into contact about one of the posts, and it never made sense because one, I think, was a California deal. It was a political deal. And mm-hmm. then there was another one. I think if I recall right, I called Missouri on. So there were some weird posts that Papa sent out at the same time that really made no sense. So was that an attempt to divert into other directions? I just always found it fascinating. And no matter who Papa ends up being, he would be the number one person I would want to interview on my podcast, other than if it's Brian Koberger, because I would never want to interview him.
It makes you wonder if maybe that was, again, post-crime, trying to steer the narrative. Maybe a little bit of, overstepping, if you will, too, realizing, okay, well, I left the sheath. Maybe I need to press the gas over here a little bit harder since I messed that part up. I don't know. Anything seems to be possible in this as we're still learning more and more about it. Let's talk about the witness trauma. This is something that, if there is a good thing about the case not going to trial, other than the families, I know some of them are happy that they don't have to go through it. Obviously the Gonzalvas, and some others, not so much. I hear both ends, and I understand both ends as best as I can, not having, you know, a child that was lost like they're going through. But the other big part of this is the ones that survive, the two roommates downstairs that don't have to go on the stand. Thank God. They don't have to be cross-examined by Ann Taylor. They don't have to have their legitimacy questioned. But you still have folks out there. And I think it's dying down. I hope it continues to die down. But there's always a big thing. What's going on with them? Why were they not calling 911? They're texting, I'm really confused, I'm freaking out. In real time, we're learning about all that, and we've learned in great detail about the accounts as to what went on that night, both in Howard Bloom's book and also in the James Patterson one. It goes into great detail. How did the FBI look at that initially? I mean, that is, you know, I guess on the surface, a little bizarre. If you got two people in the house that are not dead and everybody else is, you're going to wonder. But they obviously have a way of sorting out trauma and fact from fiction and strange behavior from traumatic behavior and behavior of someone who's just gone through, you know, one of the worst moments of their life. How was it that they walked so quickly into saying these girls have absolutely nothing to do with this when we look back on it?
Well, anytime you have a murder investigation, you start from within. You start in the smallest circle of people who are associated with your victims. So in this case, of course, the roommates are about as close as you can get because they were proximally in close and they were emotionally close and they had a relationship with them. So you have to start breaking down, interview them, and then you corroborate what they say. Well, this was easy, or not corroborate one way or the other, mm-hmm. right? Either what they said makes sense or it doesn't from the independent facts. And in this case, it was easy because they had the cell phone information. They had the texting information. They were easily able to corroborate where these girls were in the house, what they were doing. They had all that information. So it was clear to them that they weren't involved in a murder at that time. There was no blood evidence leading to them, no DNA evidence. I mean, these girls hadn't covered up anything.
Yeah.
And so thankfully, one of the things in speaking of messaging that department did, Moscow, they were brilliant in putting out, these people are off the list. Mm-hmm. Leave them alone. They are not our suspects. And in so many times, in so many cases, we don't see that happening. Like the Sebastian Rogers case, just put out, no, they're not being considered anymore, mm-hmm. whoever it might be, mm-hmm. whether grandparents, people, whatever. And in this case, they did a great job because they saw what was happening. You know, they saw the social media running wild and accusing all of these people of this murder. I mean, we even saw a professor that was accused of, and thankfully that social media person was indicted mm-hmm. for that. So that's how they were able to do it, Tony. And you always start within, and it became very clear that the inner circle wasn't responsible, that this was a stranger type offense. That became clear really very early on.
We live in a weird world with social media right now, and how anyone can almost say anything without a whole lot of repercussions. And it can be insanely damaging. We've seen it in this, and we've seen it in many other cases as well. And it's new territory where we have YouTube, where we have Facebook, where we have Twitter, we have TikTok, everything. It's all out there. Some of them are new, some of them are not. But in the big scheme of things, we're talking things that have existed really for 10, 15 years at the most, many of them less than that. And how quickly a rumor can spread and how quickly a life can be destroyed and a life can be ruined. Now, there's, of course, the balance of freedom of speech, being able to call something out and say, look, I think that someone should look here. And then there's, I'm going to call something out, but you're completely wrong on calling somebody out that has absolutely nothing against them. You're literally making things up or just going with rumors and repeating them over and over. Is this an area that we need to get better control of? Is there a way to get better control of it? I guess that's the bigger question. When you have these sort of things going on, because, I mean, these kids' lives were turned upside down with the internet trolling and sleuthing, if you will, that wanted to go down the road of blaming these young girls and even some others. But it takes a long time and it takes some money if you're going to try and go after them in a court of law. I mean, there are slander laws out there, but are they, do we need to reexamine some of this when it comes to accusing folks of crimes publicly?
You know, the slander and libel laws, I just don't think have ever caught up as of yet to mm-hmm. really what's happening with all these social media venues.
Yeah,
they're just not caught up and they need to really be rewritten. And it's interesting because slander and libel, of course, they have sort of two pieces. Well, certainly the defamation portion. You also have to prove that the person actually has had negativity happen to them, right? In other words, that something bad has happened as a result of the slander. In other words, did somebody lose their job? Mm-hmm. Did somebody get falsely arrested? Was somebody kicked out of a neighborhood or something by a homeowners association? Something like that that shows the quid pro quo, that the slander slash libel lined up with something detrimental happening to them. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is so often what the issue is, right? I mean, you can have a straight libel and slander mm-hmm. suit where you just show a lie. Mm-hmm. If you can prove it, this is the lie. Like Kash Patel recently filed a suit because a former FBI agent said that he spends more time in bars than he spends behind his desk on the seventh floor of the FBI headquarter building.
Mm-hmm.
And so Kash Patel has filed this, you know, suit against him saying that's just a lie. And I'm sure he can show mm-hmm. how much time he spent one place than the other. Of course, was that a tongue-in-cheek statement by that FBI agent? But sorry, I don't mean to digress.
No.
I just mean to say our laws just are not lined up with what happened to these kids. Yeah. For somebody who followed this from moment one, they went after Jack, the boyfriend of Kaylee Gonsalves, mm-hmm. hard. I remember saying, oh my gosh, if this is the evidence you're going to use, you would never make it as any sort of investigator if this mm-hmm. is what your, you know, the stronghold of your case is yeah. because she called him in the morning. You know, those of us who have been young ladies and had a crush or maybe on a breakup and you have some cocktails and you call, love call, your interest
yeah.
Ad nauseum, that doesn't mean he killed you.
Yeah.
So, and Dylan Mortensen, you know, because she didn't call 911. Look, none of us could have imagined the atrocities that took place. We still don't know the full breadth of those atrocities, no. but none of us would have said, oh, I think I saw somebody in a mask. What is that going on with that? I bet you my four roommates have been murdered.
Yeah. Not a thought that would go through anyone's head whatsoever. Let's talk about
maybe now.
Yeah,
maybe
well, yeah,
now.
Maybe
Tony.
Now, and also maybe now too. And I don't know. I don't know what this is. This has been something I've always done through my entire life. Lock your doors. Just lock your doors. I don't care where you live. I don't care how big a city, a small a city, how safe a town. It's just kittens that live outside of your home, and nothing else. Lock your door. And I know their lock was broken and they're college kids and they don't think about it. I feel like there needs to be a little more stressing of the importance of safety and these sort of steps with young people, because there seems to be, as all young people do, feel a little bit, unstoppable and, you know, immune from anything. But until it happens, I don't know what it'll take for that. I don't know it ever will. I think there's a nice comfort in feeling you don't have to until it's too late. But that was a big point in this one. Let's talk about the motive here, the void that still exists, at least as of now. We haven't, as of we're recording, the sentencing has not taken place, but when he did admit to the crimes, it was just a yes and a no type answer. What else do you think we're going to find out here? Do you think that we're going to learn more from Koberger about what his motivation was, and how he acted on it, why he acted on it, or is this going to be something that he's going to go to his grave, or he's going to wait for his place and time to reveal?
I just, just personally, I don't believe the motive is this difficult. I think the motive is he's a sick individual mm-hmm. who was the wallflower of life. That wanted to be this amazing, grandiose, loved, figured, and he absolutely dreamed about and fantasized about for years killing a woman who was asleep, who was beautiful, who meant his thought process and attacking viciously and then sexually assaulting them. I think that's the motive. Mm-hmm. But your question, I think, is, are we going to hear it from Koberger's mouth?
Yeah.
And my point is, I don't trust anything he would ever say. Mm-hmm. I think he will definitely, if it is made available, he'll interview someday with probably multiple people. Hopefully someday he chooses the behavioral science unit of the FBI. Actually, they're called BAU now, mm-hmm. Analysis Unit, because that's where the information is really important to put in their catalog of information so that, you know, purportedly you can identify when things like this might come. But Catherine Ramsland was his guidance counselor, taught him in four classes and had a serial killer, I believe, right under her nose and had no idea, as she well admits.
Mm-hmm.
So, I still think it's good to chronicle it to understand these people. Mm-hmm. But I don't, you know, I'm convinced that you can never see somebody and say, oh, there's one right there. He's going to do it, because I think there might be a lot of them out there, but they never act.
That's what I'm wondering about. We were talking earlier about the kind of the peeping Tom-ish type character early on, where he was looking in the window and such. There's probably a lot of that out there that we are never aware of, that do exist to this day, but they never go further. And that's the scary part of just being aware of your surroundings and what's out there. But how can you be aware when someone's, you know, out of reach and a bit out of sight, but they're still lurking? It's a scary thing to know that it might be out there, and that in reality, the odds are fairly high that they are out there. When we're looking at Koberger's, you know, lack of admission of any sort of motive, but we're trying to understand where he was coming from, where his mind went so far off. Is that something that that really does serve a purpose to hear, if not just for the families to hear the twisted world of Brian Koberger, or is it just, as some would say, just the rantings of a madman? This made sense to me because that made sense to me, but in the real world, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
You know, I think in the right hands, meaning in the behavioral psychologist hands and in the hands of, you know, they like to call them profilers, mm-hmm. but people who actually spend their life's work, like a Dr. Gary Mercado, studying mass murderers, mm-hmm. I think this information is important to them so that they can get a true analysis of the psyche of people. You know, a lot of these people end up otherwise dying and never say a word. And I think this way, you have an analysis in a totality from lots of different people who are cut from the same cloth, that they can talk about, because people are interested in it. But I'm not sure, and not to be cynical, but I just don't know that other than it being sort of interesting, intriguing, however you want to call it, trying to get into the mind of somebody like this, I don't think it has practical application for prevention, sadly.
Yeah. Maddie's injuries and all the injuries of everyone we're learning about more and more. I know you've dug into that a little bit more. What has been found out? What has been released now? And what does it tell us more about, without getting into super great detail, I mean, the brutality of this, and really just showing, I guess, more of the mind of where Koberger was on this. This wasn't just a let's run in and stab people real quick. This seemed to be like there was a target, there was intention, and there was a lot of rage.
Well, I think where the rage even more intensified was, imagine you have thought about this for years and you've planned it. You bought your K-bar months and months prior to this. You've been planning this moment that was supposed to be the most cathartic, beautiful moment, your first kill. I mean, I'm just saying what he was thinking. And I'm not trying to be poetic.
No. It's like,
speaking from his view, you're probably like, Jen, we're not talking about your wedding.
It's like the Wonder Years from hell.
It's just sick.
Remember when?
And there's Maddie laying there exactly how you want her, sound asleep, passed out. And then, oh my gosh, there's Kaylee there. So your entire dream, your vision, what you want is completely ruined now. That's how I see it. I think, obviously, you know, cut Maddie's throat, and then went on to deal with Kaylee in the most brutal of ways, because she woke up. And, you know, I think the gag marks have been talked about, which would be on the sides of the mouth. Mm-hmm. I don't think this was an official tie-up with a gag. I think this would have been done with his hand. Some people are saying the knife sheath, there was DNA of Kaylee on the knife sheath, you know, that he could have put that in the mouth. But for those of you who have been in a fight, the fighting dirty situation like this, I think he just used his hand to shut her up. And if you do that, you can see you're not going to get bit doing that and cause that. Remember, this would have been all happening very fast. We know he beat her about the face. Now we're hearing her nose was broken. I had not heard of her nose being broken before recently, nor about these gag marks. So those are the two sort of new things. We knew she had been beaten about the head. We knew it was brutal because she put up a struggle. And I think he was particularly enraged at her, not because she was the target. Remember, the target was slit the throat and have a sexual interaction. This was something different. She ruined his plan. That's how I see it.
Yeah, the anger came in that form because it stopped him from being able to do allegedly what maybe he wanted to do. That would have made this more... on the surface, a sexually motivated crime. I know there's been some that have said this wasn't, but I mean, at the end of the day, it truly was. You don't have to go that far. There doesn't have to be any sort of rape or sexual interaction to go on for it to be a sexually motivated crime.
Right. And while I figure believe he was an incel, I do believe that. I think he was involuntarily celibate because he couldn't get the girls that he wanted to be involved with him sexually. So I think he was an incel from that standpoint.
Yeah.
But I don't think he was an incel from the standpoint, and I know I disagree with the book that's been written in this vein. I agree with a lot of the book and disagree with this point. This was not that. This was a sexually motivated situation like a Bundy. That's how I see it. I've always seen it that way. I don't see it as a copycat of you know, the Roger incel that went off and murdered in that way. I mean, he murdered people he knew in his house, and he went on a rampage. That was not this. This was a stealth, well-planned out, horrible, vicious attack of a fledgling serial killer.
Had it just been the one... And this is just speculation. Had he just got the one person that he was targeting and got out of there, I wonder if we'd be talking about him today. I wonder if he would have gotten away with it. I wonder if, because there was the others there, that is, you know, the crux of this. That was the downfall that he didn't see coming. And I also do wonder if walking out of that house that day, knowing he killed four people, if that empowered him mentally as well, if because he walked out with far more than he was expecting. I'm wondering if that gave him more of the gusto to become, if he was in fact the Papa Roger, the taunting and that sort of stuff, if he thought he was really, you know, too big for his britches, as I guess my mother would have said in 1985, after walking out of there. What do you think?
Well, two things. First of all, I completely agree with you. I think it was the tussling and the rampage situation with Kaylee that caused that knife sheath to dislodge. You know, he had to have had it secured on his person in some way, either in his pocket, if he had the coveralls on and then underneath had the other outfit, or if he had regular pants, which is a possibility. We don't know. We're going to find out. If he had that secured in there, again, you always want your knife sheath handy. Typically, you don't want it on your belt because it's hard to draw. Everybody can picture that. You know, the pulling for the knife out of the sheath is very difficult to do it when it's on your person. Still, it wasn't obviously affixed to his person. We know that because it was left behind. Would it have been left behind if he simply had done what he planned with Maddie? I don't know. To your point, and that we might not know it was Brian Koberger, or at least have his DNA in this strong case. So I agree with you. That knife sheath was the ticket to a conviction.
What are you waiting to see come out? What are you most curious about that has not yet, as of our recording, been released?
I want to know about other possible victims that he had planned. And I think that they have a lot of that from the standpoint of other surveillance. I really am curious to see if what I suspect is true, and that is that there were other 1122 King Roads. He focused on that one, and that's the one he went with. Mm-hmm. But if there were any others out there, any other people that, wow, they didn't know how close they were to this. I want to know about that shoe print. I've always wondered if that Van shoe was his shoe. Mm-hmm. I want to know what size it was. I think he was size 13, if I recall correctly. Don't hold me to that. It could have even been a 15, but I've posted on the shoe size. So I think they know if it was that large size of shoe. I want to know, I really want to see the interviews of both Bethany and Dylan, the detail of it all. I mean, we have such snippets. They interviewed them multiple times, and those are going to be long, long 302s.
Yeah,
I would love to see all that information. I want to see the FD-302 of Brian Koberger that was began and ended.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see the exact video surveillance entirety of exactly pinpointing where he was, where he parked, where they have him. I know they might not have it precisely, but they're going to have it pretty close. I want to see the different bandages. I want to learn sort of from him in terms of the true, how he planned this and exactly what he did to get there.
Well, here we are, the end of the week of the sentencing of Brian Koberger, and we have more questions because more information has come out. And there, of course, was the sentencing itself, which was very interesting, very emotional. I mean, that whole thing ran the gamut of emotions. Here to discuss the sentencing, and here also to discuss some of the new pieces that we've learned since things have been unsealed, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, and also author of this book, Unbreakable Alliances. Go get it wherever books are sold. I have a library on the front of my desk now of your books, of Siobhan's books, and I just,
I know. You're so kind. We mentioned so many books on our show, too, because it's not just what we take in the world around us, but in order to gain, knowledge, background, and context, we have to keep consuming other information. And just like we consumed Howard Bloom's book voraciously when The Night Comes Falling about the case, and then also I'm just finishing up James Patterson's book. Which is a different take. I know it's not where we started the show, but it is a different take. It's more of a story because James Patterson's a storyteller. Mm-hmm. He's did the editing, I think, for the writer. But it's a different way to approach an understanding of the case. And it's more about the individuals involved that in all their nooks and crannies and their life arcs, all of them individually. So it was a good read. I think it supplements Howard's book really nicely.
It does. I mean, there's 100 some chapters in that thing. But spoiler alert, they're not super long chapters. Like they're short chapters, but there's 100 some chapters. So I'm about chapter 70 or so right now on that one as I'm working my way
through. It's funny. It's this unwritten competition I'm trying to
beat. It is. I know. I got it. I'm like, I'm reading this book right now. Like, I'm starting it too.
Yep. As he's on the plane flying back, I'm like, no, I'm going
to
beat you.
I was listening to it in the airport. I was talking to my family and had one ear in with the book.
Yeah, I remember. You said you're on chapter 50. It's like, I got it moving.
Yep. There you go. So let's talk about the actual sentencing the other day. We were on together for a bit. And then eventually it did wrap up with everybody giving their parts, and the star of the day, I think, not that anybody should be a star of this, but the one who I think made the most impact and the most, not only impact to everyone out there watching, but to Koberger most importantly, and to herself being able to get this out off of her chest, for lack of a better term, Olivia Gonzalez there. And you see where it came from once the whole family talked. It's like, oh, I get where they learned this. It was powerful. What was your thoughts on that and just how she eviscerated him? And how do you think it read to Koberger?
Like you, Tony, I'm watching this live with you, and I've watched victim witness statements before, and it started out exactly like I thought it was going to. Gut-wrenching with the roommates, with the people that love those beautiful children in their lives. It started with Koberger sitting there stone-faced, just unimpacted by anything, right? And then the Gonzalez got up there. And when the dad turned the podium towards him directly, and then, like you said, when Olivia got up there and completely eviscerated him, and that's the only word that can come to mind, because I think what they did as a family, and they've been on a tear since the beginning of this, and they've been very open and vocal about it, and Olivia as well. Patterson's book talks about her quite well, about what she was doing on the Facebook groups and pages and stuff. They did such a deep dive on not to tell the story of what they lost, but to make his life miserable as possible. Mm-hmm. And I mean, when you're listening to not just Olivia, but her dad, the mom, and just all these people involved, you can see, and I've never seen this before, that they're going to spend the rest of their lives both living and making his a living hell as much as they can. Mm-hmm. It was profound is what it was. I've never been inspired by victim witness statements before. I was inspired listening because they knew how to hit him. Mm-hmm. It's like, I think they must have had consultants that they talked to about how to make an impact with a psychopath, because really that's what they did. You know, they didn't say, woe is me. They didn't say, I mean, she just went at him as a human being.
I have no idea. I mean, if she wrote that herself, I mean, it was wonderfully written. But I'm not trying to downplay her performance by any means. It was amazing. But I do wonder if ChatGPT was involved. just a hair. I mean, and I would use it because it helps you craft what you're wanting to say in the most impactful way possible. And I could see like that would have been very helpful in that sort of case to really just... I mean, it was precision strikes directly at Koberger's psyche.
And now the second part of what you said, Tony, how it landed with him.
Yeah.
Hard to tell. You know, he is predictably unresponsive, unemotional and everything. But if we're going to project onto him what we are theorizing him in high levels of psychopathy, again, not licensed clinicians, no testing done, whatnot, but... the words that she used to diminish his academic prowess, to attack him as a man, to attack him in all these different areas, because the only thing that motivates someone that has high levels of psychopathy, as we've said numerous times, is a sense of grandiosity and superiority. Mm-hmm. And that's what she attacked very, very, like you said, precision strikes on absolutely everything. It wasn't the woe is me. I mean, you can almost see him... Boy, you can't see it because he didn't give anything. But when all the other victim statements were so emotionally delivered, and gosh, they were so powerful, and you could almost think that someone like him was probably just eating that up because he's just that horrible. But then when she came in there and flipped that script, I don't want to say she victimized him because he's not a victim, but she made him feel like a victim.
She put him in his place. Yeah.
100%. I've never seen that before.
Yeah.
Quite done so well. So if she did use ChatGPT, good. I don't care what.
Good. I don't care what, how she did it, but whatever she did, damn. I mean, 100%. That was amazing. What she did. Many family members, people in the courtroom noted, even Olivia noted, she said to Brian Enten of News Nation that he was clenching his jaw and he might have forgotten to blink. Others noticed the same thing, specifically when Olivia was addressing him. And I noticed that too. With the others, you could tell, like, there was almost like a, I don't know, I want to say jovial, but he was just kind of, I felt like he was eating it up from the very beginning. And then when she came on, you could tell. I mean, and the fact that he did tighten up, his jaw's clenched and his eyes are not blinking.
Yep.
What do you think was going through his mind? I mean, is any of that resonating with him? Obviously, his prism is so different than everyone else's. So you get, it's like, how is he taking this? Is he just getting hurt and then just lashing out in his brain at her and just calling? I mean, or is it just, yeah, I mean, is it confirmation over and over of what a, you know, pathetic human being he actually is? And it's just, you know, being pounded in again as he had most of his life.
The thing that, again, projecting trying to use that deep empathy with someone as vile as this, kind of reversing it as he was taking it. And you made some great points, and Brian Enton has always been on top of this. You know, if we saw deviation from that very, very nondescript baseline of his with the jaw clench and everything, it means that he was hearing the words she was saying and it was changing his thought pattern, most likely for the negative, because those are those tightening and stressful reactions he's having. Now, the way I was interpreting using that deep active, you know, context of him from that position, we said this before too, before the sentencing, was that the shame of the verdict in this, where he gets life and not death sentence, was that he has hope every day of change. He has hope of being able to pursue a degree. He has hope of being studied by others because people are so interested in him as this psychopath or as this serial killer wannabe or all these things. And what happened was every word she was using, every statement she was making, she was taking that away from him. She was diminishing that. In other words, the only thing I was thinking that might be going through his mind was all those things he was actually looking forward to, gone.
Yeah.
And so he might have been playing that forward a little bit, like listening to those words saying, hey, as soon as this is over, as soon as I suck in all your remorse and all the impact I caused, I got a great day coming tomorrow because I'm going to go here and I'm going to do all these things and people are going to want to talk to me. And she completely erased that. Mm-hmm. And she demonstrated, not just for today and Steve, the dad as well, you could tell that they're going to spend the rest of their lives ensuring he never has that moment of glory or fame that he thinks he's going to have. And I think he could sense that. I think he could feel that. And I think he believed it.
Yeah, I think that that's going to come as a little surprise to little Brian. Another big
little
part.
Brian, that's a great word.
Yeah, yeah.
Little Brian.
Little Brian, yeah. another big part of it, Steve Gonsalves is up there, and we talked about it very briefly during that break, but I want to expand on it more. There was a lot of people who were calling for prison justice in the in the victim impact. I've never seen it that many times in a row. Everything from sodomizing him to killing him behind bars, and it came up a lot from a lot of people. I'm wondering how much Brian Koberger has contemplated that being his future. Or if he thinks he's just going to be back there, you know, writing a book and taking interviews and all of that. I wonder if he's considered, you know, you are going to eventually have to interact with people here. They will put you into Gen Pop at some point in time. And there's a big target on your head. And you have a family out there ready to fill canteens and a world, I would say, that's ready to fill canteens who's followed this case for whoever is the lucky person that takes him out?
That's a great question because it resonated with me as well. Matter of fact, it's because we do so much true crime and because people, you can look at your search, you know, things that you put in Google and everything. I actually precluded myself from putting it into Google this morning. Can someone actually do, you know, from the outside, like can Steve Gonsalves actually put a hit on Brian behind bars and would he be prosecuted for it? I mean, I was really curious about it as well. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm curious about that as well, but I was afraid to put it in the Google machine to find out. That being said though, I would have been 100% on thinking that, that's a likelihood, but at the same time, How often does that happen? It's like, you know me, I'm always going for data and baselines on frequency, commonality. And I just don't have any data points on. I need to do some deeper research without triggering Google to come at me.
Yeah.
But I'm also curious about, he's a scary guy. He's a little scarier than I thought he was going to be because that one jailhouse report we had of the one guy that was going to like hit him or got pissed off at him and then Brian's reaction to him was creepy scary.
Yeah.
So it'll be really, really interesting if anyone wants to give him a time of day again to kind of see if anyone's willing to engage him just because, I mean, he's a cesspool.
He is a cesspool. Yeah. I don't think he's that intimidating to a lot of people behind bars.
No, I don't think he's intimidating. Yeah, again, it's just the if.
You just don't know what he's going to do. Like that would be the thing. You just don't know what that mind is going to produce, and then what.
That was also in the jail, not in the prison population, which is very different. Yeah. So I'll be I think his life, I think what he got during the victim statements in the sentencing was a not the rosy life he thought he was going to have. That turned dark for him than I think he anticipated.
Yeah.
Thankfully. Thankfully.
Yes. I mean, I don't know that this has ever been I've joked about it over the years of like somebody should start a business, Canteen for Kills. I mean, it's totally insane and illegal and you couldn't actually do it. Like you're literally like it would be a hit machine, but you can't do that. But I mean, if you were to literally be in contact with a prisoner, I mean, all that shit's monitored, obviously. And you were saying, I'll fill your canteen directly in a letter. Yeah, you would be charged with murder, with ordering. Well, but if you don't do it directly, if you're just in the ether like this, and people are like, hey, I wonder what that, I would bet people would fill the canteen of whoever does that. Not like, go do it, but just that person knows damn well they will have canteen for the rest of their lives. They'll be the Snickers king if that happens.
So, and here's what I can envision happening more likely than not. And this is what was really, again, I don't know, was part of design or not, or is just manifesting because of it. The reality, you know, I love playing these things forward from the actions we've witnessed and had. Right now, whoever watched inside that prison, who's in population, watched his sentencing, is thinking to themselves, without anyone filling anyone's canteen, without anyone reaching out to them, is thinking to myself, I can be a hero.
Yeah.
I don't have to do anything and I will be a hero.
You don't even need incentive, honestly, I think, on this. I
mean, exactly. See what I mean? Yeah. So the Consalvises actually set Koberger up for a very, very rough time whenever he actually hits general population, no matter what anyone else says from that point of view. That to me was the most grandest strategy, whether by design or chance, that I've ever seen. Yeah. Because he's doomed.
Yeah, they didn't have to like be pen pals with anybody behind bars. Although I do wonder if they are.
Right. Because think about this too. Yeah. So you go to other wackadoos, broken brain, people like Lori de Belvallo behind bars who killed her kids, but she's got this element of crazy charisma behind her that she can manipulate people and everything because she can become likable, she can endear herself because she's just a nutter, right? Mm-hmm. Koberger's not even likable to anyone by anyone. And so he can't even rely on his personality to get by, to at least make one ally. And so I don't see a good day for him coming ever.
No.
Thank God.
As far as we know, as far as I know, and tell me if you've found out anything different, Koberger's dad was not in the.
That's what I heard too. I didn't get confirmation, but I heard it was just a mom and a sister there.
That's what I was understanding too. Again, I can't confirm it, but that's what I generally believe from what I've heard. What do you think that says? Dad, I mean, dad's the one who seemed to be the one that was, reaching out. He would go drive with him back home. And he did it more than once. The last time was the last time he did it, but that wasn't a unique thing. He did try to basically be there for his son that he knew was a bit off. He's not there. I mean, for something like this, I don't think it's a, well, shoot, I have to work moment. I'm going to guess there was some meaning behind that.
I don't know if it's meaning other than he himself, because I mean, just think about the pain he's in. Just think about the pain that the family's in. And I like that they acknowledge that. I mean, I think, again, this is the 30,000 foot level we don't know behind the scenes, but you have a family, every family's been devastated by this one horrendous individual. Mm-hmm. And you got a dad who tried so hard to save his son and ultimately he failed.
Yeah.
And he's now got to listen to, I mean, can you imagine sitting in that courtroom, listening to all these people say these things about your son? Mm-hmm. I don't think it was a statement. I think it was unbearable for him potentially. And the other thing that struck me that Koberger was actually communicating with his mother so much behind bars. You really start wondering, what are they communicating? Because I thought about that a lot. What do you say to a son who's admitted to doing these horrendous things? The only thing I could think of was, you try your best to put yourself in a similar situation, as horrendous that is. And I think the only thing that you really can talk about is what you're going to do, what your days are going to look like, how to deal with this kind of person, you know, kind of like I, you know, we all do with our own kids, you know, as they're facing the challenges in life, kind of dismiss the actions they took, because if you're going to choose to keep contact with your son, what are you going to talk about? You're going to talk about survival. That's it.
And I mean, I guess, I mean, it is very much a personal decision for them, but I don't know that I could if I were in their shoes.
I don't know either.
I think I would be, you're done. I'm like, you're dead to me. I mean,
why it's really weird the mother was in so much contact.
Yeah, that's what makes it weird. I mean, it's like, why? Why? Like, what do you, you're there for your little boy who did these horrible, horrendous things, and he's a monster. He can barely communicate as it is.
And he's really no longer who he was as your little boy. I mean, you know, the only you know, stupid analogy I have in my head is, you know,
Chucky.
Star Wars analogy. Yeah, that. But I'm thinking Star Wars. I'm thinking little Anakin Skywalker all of a sudden turns into Darth Vader and he's dead to everyone. I mean, he's, you know, the person he was gone because he chose this dark path. And I think the same thing here.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard, it's horrendous to say, but to a family member, he's dead.
I don't know that it would, there's any benefit to the living to be in contact with Brian Koberger, even if it's your kid, your brother, whatever it may be. I don't see how that is a positive thing in anyone's life whatsoever. I would feel like they're dead. They are clearly not human, you know, not on a level that one could communicate with any benefit. I feel like you'd be feeding the monster in any way, shape, or form, giving him any sort of little bit of positivity in their day of allowing, you know, mom to talk to him. Like, I don't know. I mean, I would want to be waiting for him to die.
I think she's feeding the monster. I think you hit it right on the head, and that's a shame. Again, it's pure conjecture. We have no idea what they are talking about, but you feel for her, but don't feed that monster, man, because he's not your little boy.
I'm wondering how much those jail calls are similar to the ones of Stefan Stearns, the guy who killed Matty Soto. Those jailhouse calls are out there. We've played them before. And dad is a more pragmatic one, not necessarily getting into the emotions of it, but I think pretty much knowing his son is a monster, but mom is the one who seems a bit more in denial about the whole thing. I have no idea what those conversations are like now that he's admitted to all of these things and taken the plea, but I do wonder, I don't know, there's a line, I think, at some point where it's like, I'll be there for you no matter what, not this. Not this. You slaughter four people and you have zero empathy or remorse about it. I mean,
and not just that. I mean, they're looking at him in the courtroom.
Yeah.
He didn't give a rat's ass.
No.
I mean, where do you, as a parent, where do you even make the connection? I mean, I don't even, the hardest part for me to understand during this whole thing, believe it or not, was, and I'm not doubting it, because Howard Bloom's got a great insight to this and other people have a great insight too. I have, because when you watch him in the courtroom, you have such a hard time imagining that what anyone thinks is going to influence his choices. It's hard to imagine he's going to make a choice to make it easier on his parents, because he doesn't seem to give a rat's ass.
Yeah.
I mean, psychopaths don't care about others. I mean, I'm not doubting it if people are saying it and there's data points for him to support it. I still think he did it for himself. He thought, kind of like what we were saying before, I think he said, all right, I'm looking at the data. It's not looking good for me to get off. So the best thing I can do is, hey, let's create this new future for myself. Mm-hmm. Where I'm going to be this, I'm going to be studied, I'm going to write a book, I'm going to do all these great things, and I still have something to look forward to because I didn't care about the world anyway. And I think in my mind, but since he's all about him and the grandiosity, he decided to get the plea deal when offered to him again and probably pressed by defense because she knows she's losing. Mm-hmm. Less so than I did it for mom. I mean, does he look like the type of guy that you'd say, I did it for mom?
No.
See, that's what I mean? I mean, see, the data doesn't support it. I mean, he's me. You know, make my own future. Be in charge of what I think happens.
The only thing I can contemplate would be, they're talking a lot. He is getting something out of mom's communication with him. And I'm wondering, you know, Howard contemplated that mom was in control for a while, saying, don't take the plea, don't take the plea. I'm wondering if mom eventually said, take the plea. And if you don't take the plea, I'm not going to be able to continue talking to you anymore. And I wonder if he saw that as like, that's his own lip. That's like the only little lifeline, the only human being on this planet who still has a inch of empathy for him. And even she was, I don't know, this is just my conjecture. I wonder if she's the one that drove it. And it wasn't in a way of, I'm going to take the plea to protect my mom, but mom maybe said, I'm going to withdraw any contact with you. And that was the carrot on the stick that made him do it. Cause that would be a me move. That would be a, well, that goes away. I mean, right. And maybe she just, you know, she knew, they all knew he did it. And
I can see that
for the best, for the good of everyone, just take the plea, just do it. Otherwise you're going to get killed.
So I'm going to differ on the language for the good of everyone. Yep. He don't care about everyone. He's for the good of himself because I think you hit it right on the head there. So if the mother influenced it is because of the impact it was going to have on him about not having some sort of validation from the only person left on the entire planet until you get the friggin' groupies that are now going to want to talk to him is his mom. So yeah. And that's why she's feeding, like you said, she's feeding the beast.
Yeah. And that's
where. Part of that beast.
Yeah. You got to.
That's right. Consolvuses will take care of the entire thing.
Exactly. The wheels are already in motion.
They set it in motion. They can just sit back and watch a show at this point. That family. I tell you what, anyone that is if your needs, if any of them are unemployed at this point, I mean, who wouldn't hire them? I mean, those are doers. God. That's a family of doers.
Yeah. No kidding. No kidding.
Problem solving doers.
I put a question out on our YouTube channel. Will Brian Koberger survive prison? If not, how long before prison justice takes him out? I just posted it like right as we began talking here. I haven't got any responses on it yet, but it'll be interesting to see what the general take is on all of that.
Yes, it will. Boy, that's gonna. I thought, Tony, we were gonna be done and over with this, but the Consolvas is really, they're not gonna let it hang. I mean, you see families that are so traumatically impacted as victims through these horrors, and I don't think I've ever seen anyone go on offense as much as this.
No, this is, you're on a mission. I'm on a mission from God to take you out.
They were not victims in that courtroom at all.
No, they definitely brought it. New information has come out in the case against Brian Koberger. This from the unsealing of many, many documents, the police reports coming out, and there's a lot more to come. It's basically just a matter of how quickly can they get this information into a public forum that's adaptable to be consumed. Some of the pieces that have come out are very interesting, I think it almost challenges a little bit the idea that Koberger just happened to decide on that house that night. There's reports from Kaylee Gonzalez that she thought she was being watched while walking her dog. Other roommates hearing noises, seeing a shadowy figure nearby the house leading up to this. There's other things as well that we can get into. Do you think it was Koberger? Do you think this was part of his stalking that they, I mean, obviously we knew he went by the house all those times. We don't know what else he did, but I'd be very curious if he entered that house prior to this actually taking place and had a bit of an idea of its layout. They had a door that was broken that got off its hinges, literally, like 9 days before all this went down.
I think there's a good possibility of it. As human beings, matter of fact, every time a tragedy like this happens, and I'm doing some news thing other than yours, you know, one of the things that cops always ask the public to do is be diligent. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times what I'll do is I'll try to define for people what diligence looks like. And what diligence looks like is, hey, everyone pay attention to what the baseline normal is around you. So that when something deviates from that baseline, you're going to say, hey, that's a little different, and you pay attention. Mm-hmm. Because as human beings, we can get that what I call the spider sense or tremors in the force, or when something looks different. And so what we're seeing with some of the reporting we're seeing is that the girls were seeing some tremors in the force, some deviations from that normal mm-hmm. look like. So something or someone was causing that deviation that gave them a little bit of a creepy off feeling. Mm-hmm. Could have been Koberger. Yes. No doubt. Could have been other creepy people. Yeah, because there's a lot of creepy people in the world, especially if you have a house that's got high traffic in the area. Yeah. So it could be a lot of things, but I would not rule out that it could have been Koberger, especially since, and I'm still holding with this, you know, he went to Idaho to murder. That was part of what he wanted to do, because he bought the knife before he went out there. I think it was in his mind that he was going to do some sort of crime like this. Mm-hmm. Part of the next phase of that was identifying victims and identifying location. I think he was collecting data points on both simultaneously. I think the venue itself created an opportunity because it was so open, because it had high traffic area, because it represented, if his symbology comes in at all, represented the things he couldn't have, and that is being included with people that liked each other. Mm-hmm. Then you also had the girls.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, you know, well liked, well out there, and also, you know, up in the room where you could see, not Maddie, it was it Maddie? That you could, that she,
yeah, it was Maddie. Yeah,
he was Maddie, you know, yeah, by her window. So
which is alluded to a lot in that new, the James Patterson book,
right,
that he would sit outside the window. I mean, this is the conjecture of Patterson, that he would, yeah, sit outside that window and watch her. And I believe it, that makes total sense. It also makes more sense too of this amping up in behavior where he finally did go into the house, where we don't have anything. There's no evidence that he was on social media following them or anything. One would think at this day and age, that, you know, if you got a thing for the girl, and obviously it's more than a thing, this was obsessive stalking, but if you're the obsessive stalker, you'd be on their social media. You'd be looking at the mm-hmm. pictures of them. I mean, I guess one could say, you know, maybe he was and it was just erased and he wasn't necessarily following. There may have been that. I mean, there's ways I'm sure one could do that and really never show up in a history. So I would wonder if that existed, but he certainly wasn't following them. But I think it was more physicality for Koberger. I think that looking in that window, that old way of being creepy, you know, old school creep rather than new school creep online. He was following that, and he's sitting there and he's watching and he's fantasizing every day. And this is how he's consuming that fantasy of his. And then at one point it breaks and he has to go in. He has to do something. But it does make me wonder, was this planned for that night, or was this someday when the moment's right, when it strikes, I'm going to strike. And I wonder if this just happened to be the night that he just couldn't hold it back and chose to go in, and then is utterly shocked that there's all these other people in there. I'm assuming he thought Xana was sleeping, and I don't think he anticipated Kaylee being there. And I think that plays out a bit too in what we've later learned now about the brutality of all of this.
Yeah. And the brutality of it really kind of struck me as well, when we're trying to identify this arc of his, because the one thing I wasn't really seeing until we've seen some deeper dives and some releases is that arc. And Howard alluded to it as well. Mm-hmm. And his arc is the rage arc.
Yeah.
And even though he didn't do anything as violent as this, there was a rage arc, and so here's my conjecture. He went out there with the intention of, I'm going to eventually do this, mm-hmm. because I want to experience this because of the emotional need and whatever fantasy, you know, whatever, yeah, he wanted to do to impress people, all that we've talked about. But I think as he's going through and being that teaching assistant, and it's ramping up, that anger and rage is ramping up because he's not being recognized. He's being, you know, turned in for being creepy. He's getting counseled. He's almost being thrown out of the program. It kind of reached that crescendo as he's already stalking this area out because he's identified the house. He's identified people in the house. And then all of a sudden we have this snap moment. He's like, his anger and rage bubbled over. So he then was ready to start executing, mm-hmm. This is the execution. That's why the brutality, especially with the first victim, was it 70 stab wounds?
It's high.
Yeah. That is rage, mm-hmm. pure, unadulterated rage. And so that was, it's got to come from somewhere. And that was the escalation. It was a rage escalation, I think, was probably coming from his time as being a teaching assistant and also being lambasted and sucking at that.
Well, and sucking at this too. I mean, literally, yeah. I think my guess is he went in thinking he was going to get to Maddie, and there's going to be an essay, and he was going to kill her. Or I don't even know, maybe not even kill, maybe just that and get out and be masked and get away. But he gets confronted by all of these other people. And even that, even the plan he had gets screwed up. And I could, in a really, I can almost like picture it in like a movie type way where he goes in, he thinks he's going to do this. And all of a sudden, you know, just that look he has about him, that blank stare, like, oh my gosh, he's met with reality that wasn't exactly what he thought it was going to be. And he's like, just going nuts. Just anybody who's in his way, and yeah, they screwed it up. I feel like the excessive rage in this case was more so because even this plan he messed up. And so he just went to town, and I'm not trying to be crass or anything, but he just went crazy on these people because of that rage, because again, he was stopped and his plan went to shit. And why is that? Because these people were there, not because he shouldn't be in this house doing what right. He's doing, but because they got in his way. There's no other explanation, really.
And from the very beginning, I remember, you know, when we started covering this together 3 years ago, the first thing that struck me, and it's held true throughout this, is that he planned this as if this was a final in high school, mm-hmm. and he's a student, and he's going to execute this, and his supreme arrogance was his undoing the entire time, because he failed this exam and he could not, this guy thankfully could not innovate.
Yeah.
He could not take something new, take a new data. And as much as he thinks he's so smart and great, as Olivia was saying, he's a horrible student. He's the worst student there possibly is, because he didn't learn a thing outside of the stovepipe of what he thought reality was. And he thought this stovepipe in which he saw the world mm-hmm. was it, and he's completely right and everyone else is an idiot.
Yeah.
Which, as tragic as this is, I still think had he been a better student, this would he would not have made the mistakes, and this might have continued to go on.
Oh, we also learned how sloppy he was as well. There's Tinder messages out there now, and this would have been big as evidence had this gone to court, connected to Koberger, where allegedly he's mentioning K-bar knives and dark fantasies of, like, what's the worst way to die? You know, like people talk about on Tinder.
And doing it on that Facebook page as well.
Like, what on earth? This is just how screwed up his mind is in terms of, like, oh yeah, go on Tinder. People are looking for that. They're looking to find a partner. They're looking to hook up. They're not looking to chat about K-bar knives and the worst way to die. But Koberger thinks that's going to be the calling card to get some.
You know, here's something I hadn't thought of before, but when you're talking about that on Tinder, it really made me think that there was a voice some time ago. I actually looked up the stats on this, and it's true. And here's what true. I don't remember the exact numbers, but the number of people and by gender that are into true crime, it's vastly dominant on the female side. Females are definitely much more into true crime stories and stories like this than males definitely are. And I really wonder if part of his motivation was that.
How so?
Maybe trying to, you know, so he's kind of talking on these forums. He's on the Facebook page that was created around mm-hmm. this case and Tinder. And he's on these forums trying to you know, share his expertise and get these thoughts and opinions. And who's he interacting with for predominantly on these sites?
Women.
Women.
Yeah. Well, because look at his attorney team. I mean, I don't know that he had a whole lot of choice in that matter, but yeah, he's, I thought it was funny.
I know I'm on the way out on the conjecture thing on that one, but yeah. it's just since you brought up Tinder on it and what he was posting, it's like, you know, it's the only time, I'm thinking about it, it's the only time where he's actually having an interaction with a female that actually might have been halfway interested in the things he was saying.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because he has this rage for women and he's being represented by all women.
Look happy in the courtroom with him at sentencing.
Oh my God. There was like Ann Koberger used to be, or not Ann Koberger, Ann Taylor.
I know, I always forget her name.
Ann Taylor, she was visibly like, I'm sitting a little bit further away from this guy this time. Like, he's not. It wasn't like it was in the hearings.
No, it almost, you felt, I felt for them.
Yeah.
To a degree.
They did their job, without a doubt.
Shame, it felt like shame was just leaking out of them.
Oh my God.
And then, and I don't know who the assistant attorney is on the other, on his, on Koberger's left.
Yeah.
But I saw her smirk when Olivia started talking and Steve Gonsalves started talking.
It's I did too.
There could have just been me trying to see what wasn't there, but I was watching them when they were eviscerating him, and Anne was, again, she kept her head down most of the time.
I thought I got a little nod or two out of Anne when Olivia was letting him have it.
Yeah,
like, especially when they were talking about like prison justice. I swear to, I could be wrong. I was watching it, you know, in real time. Oh, and I think I saw a little bit of, yeah, please take him off this planet.
Oh, it was really good.
Because, I mean, I can't imagine, like, what's, I mean, I asked Bob Mata this the other day, defense attorney. I said, Bob, what is she thinking right now in that courtroom from a defense attorney standpoint? And he said, I know exactly what she's thinking. I saved my client's life, and I did my job.
Right.
And she did. That was her job. She succeeded at doing her job. The question at the end of the day is, okay, yes, but you're a human being too, and you're hearing all of this horror that your client that you so, you know, desperately saved the life of did these horrible things. Do you feel good about yourself? I mean, it's your job. That's why we have defense attorneys. I mean, I'm not against defense attorneys, but, you know, I guess that comes with the territory in something like this.
I've never done a deep dive on this, and I'm sorry, when dealing with Ann Taylor. She wasn't court appointed, was she? She was
court appointed.
Right?
She was court appointed.
Was court appointed. Yep. Okay.
She was the only one of the, and the issue with it was because there was very few death penalty qualified appointed attorneys.
Remember that.
In the state. And she was one of them. And that's who she got.
Hey, because the only reason I asked because I was curious, like she did a really good job for court appointed.
Oh. But she's I mean, to be a death penalty qualified attorney, you're going to get a good one. You know, it's not a speeding or, you know, a petty crime or something. So you're getting
a hard job for her, huh?
Yeah, you get the best of the best there. But yeah, I mean, I would feel, I don't know. I would think I'd be bathing in Purell for days after all of that, because it was just so, so extreme.
You definitely got to believe in the law more than you believe in people, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's good. They're out there. There's wrongly convicted people.
Then you have those ones that represented, Richard Allen, Delphi.
Exactly. Exactly. You have, people that are wrongly convicted. Obviously that's not the case.
Not the case here. Oh my gosh.
No. The K-bar knife, obviously the sheath left behind. We still don't know where the murder weapon is. We don't know exactly how the hell he got in and out of there with as horrible and gruesome as this scene was without, you know, leaving a trail behind him. I mean, I think that's still a bit of a mystery. You know, I don't know how you physically do that. How do you get out of there without leaving a trail of some sort? That to me still kind of defies a lot of logic on this.
I think the greatest thing he did for his planning was that.
Mm-hmm.
I think his OCD behaviors were actually helped him in that sense. Mm-hmm. From what I understand, again, some of the leakage we heard about the car was that it looked like the car had been totally disassembled to get all the blood splatter that could have even been out of there. But yeah, so the one area he did a good job in, and it's only one, was that, you know, to have no DNA whatsoever after he created a disaster zone of blood splatter and DNA all over the place, to have none that could be tied to him. I think that's going to go down as one of the most profound things too, just because, especially with our technology today. I mean, think about it. We were able to get a minor, I think it was a thumbprint, like half of a thumbprint, not a thumbprint itself, but the DNA off a snap of a knife sheath that was under a bloody body, to be able to tie it to the dad to go back to him. Yet they could find not a molecule of any of the victims anywhere on him, his car, his apartment, or anything. That's remarkable.
And, you know, they didn't find it. I do wonder if it was there. Because there's a couple things I look at in this case and go,
you mean the knife?
Not the knife. Just in general. Like, was there more evidence that was missed in the investigation itself? I mean, the house got torn down. I do wonder, because there are elements to this that they've come out and said, well, this is this, this is that. One of those specifically being the Papa Roger online persona. Yeah, and they said, no, that was not him. We have concluded that was
They said it wasn't him, really.
They said it wasn't him. I don't believe that.
I don't believe it either.
I don't. Then you didn't look hard enough, I think, is the answer to that question. You didn't look hard enough, because there's no way in hell someone had a online picture that looks just like Brian Koberger releasing information that no one else has knowledge of publicly before. No, it was him. How else would this have happened? How else would you, if it was a different picture, sure, maybe so you could have some nutcase out there just spewing stuff and it just happened to be right. You don't have some nutcase spewing it and having the picture of Koberger.
And so the only, so here's, even when you're looking at these online forums, and there's a lot of noise because there's a lot of people on them that were doing it. The thing in that case too, with the Papa Roger thing is, so people are generally commenting on the same thing. So you're going to get a wave of statements, of theories, and all these things that are waving like this. And then you have only one person that spikes up like this with the things they're saying, like, you got to pay attention to that one because that one's different. What is making that one person different in the things they're saying? Because there's a spike, because you have a normal behavior of all these other people, but you have one spike. Now, if there's like 3 to 5 to 10 other people saying the same thing, maybe, but one, that's again, laws of probability. I'm always going on probabilities. So the probability of that actually having been him is higher than it not being him.
I mean, look at this. And
I know, I remember when that photo came
out. And the damn name, Roger. It's a nod to Elliot Roger.
I know.
Of course it's him. And that's when I saw that of, oh, it's not him. Look harder.
Yeah.
So what else did we not look hard enough at, too, is my question. If that you believe is not him. And why do you believe it's not him? What was the thing that brought you to that conclusion? Was it an IP address? Can you definitively tell me who it was then? Or can they definitively say off the record, we know it was this person? I mean, I don't buy that one. I know Coffin Daffer posted about it because she was big on it. She was probably the biggest person on it forever. And I'm actually talking to her this afternoon. I'm curious to get her thoughts. But she had tweeted about it saying, okay, it wasn't him. I was wrong. I don't think she was wrong. Again,
let's just look at data.
Yeah.
Let's look at the data points. It was Papa, what the hell's the name again?
Roger.
Papa Roger, from what I understand, he was the only one that came out with these theories about the knife and all these things
And started steering people away when they were talking about the Elantra, things that were like solid of like how to find him. No, that's a red herring. He steered people.
It's one person. See, that's you got a spike. It's one person. I have a hard time steering away from one person. So here's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm in law enforcement and I got a spike like that. That's where we focus all resources and guns on that one.
Mm-hmm.
And you flush that out until you are 100% convinced that that's not the person. And you can then explain it, you know, with whether it's in the moment where, you know, at the time or in the documents that we should be getting now. So with the gag order lifted, one thing they should be able to do, if it was indeed not him, is show you exactly what they did to say it wasn't him.
Yeah. I mean, you have to name the name of who it is, obviously, but why? It's not just it wasn't him. Why? How was that not him? Because I have very little faith in other cases that you're not going to be able to recognize people like this if you're thinking that this is not him.
And so if it's not him, how come the person that actually is, with all the notoriety they could have for being so spot on, how come they haven't come forward?
Exactly. Well, and this too. I mean, the man was obsessed with being other people because he was such a shitty human being himself. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, American Psycho. We called that right away with the picture of him, this one with the shower. And there it's in the shower. I mean, it was a breadcrumb.
It's also a self-made self-made trophy.
It is. And it was him trying to be elusive. He didn't know the picture was ever going to get out. That was for him to look at and go, ha, ha, ha. But if anyone ever did find it, yes, it's a nod to Psycho. It's a nod to American Psycho with the getup. It's a nod to Norman Bates. It's a nod to the thumbs up Bundy. I mean, it's all this. And yes, and there's Papa fucking Roger. So it's him. I mean, this was his propensity to do this. And he probably still will do this from behind bars. There's going to be more of him trying to emulate other people. I think he's going to go down BTK's road a bit and really try to communicate and have some sort of dialogue with people.
I think part of what I think, one of the reasons he took that plea deal is because he saw he could be another BTK from behind bars.
Exactly.
The problem is, BTK is a lot smarter, he's a lot smoother, and he's a lot more congenial.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, literally, he, as horrendous as BTK is, he's a more likable guy than Koberger.
Yep.
So what I envision Koberger trying to do is BTK-like things, and he's going to fumble the ball.
And that's the thing with this, too. And that's a good point. This kid has always fumbled the ball on everything he has. So what is there to study about Brian Koberger at the end of the day? Honest to God. I mean, I get
it's like Olivia said, he's nothing but a wannabe.
He is. Because, look, BTK is worth studying. There's a long history of his shit that he terrorized Wichita for, like, decades. Ted Bundy's worth studying. All these people who had a lot of reps, who got away with it over and over and over again and manipulated people over and over again, they are worth studying. Koberger didn't manipulate anybody. Koberger was an idiot.
Oh, my God. It just struck me because all these other people, like BTK, Ted Bundy, all that, they were original.
Yes. He's not.
Koberger's a mimic.
Like, other than studying him as a mimic, there's nothing to study here. He wasn't good at what he did.
Right.
He wasn't.
He sucked at being everyone else.
Yes. He sucked at being himself, and he sucked at being everyone else. Yeah. And it's because of the way his mind works. I just don't know what there is to study here. And I'm glad there are people like Catherine Ramsland out there who I'm sure will hopefully, you know, get to do a little insight on this.
And I hope they take the judge's lead on him. Yeah. Who says, hey, study him, but don't release it. You know, use it in academic circles and things like that, but give him no notoriety.
It's going to be out there. It'll be a book. We know that's going to happen. But I just don't know that there's any depth here. It was a very perplexing case to watch. It was outrageous of what he did, but he ain't no Ted Bundy. He's not BTK. He's a student. He got away with it for a short period of time, like less than a month, and then he left a ton of evidence.
Failed wannabe.
Yeah, I mean, because it wasn't just the, the knife sheath and the DNA as being the linchpin. We're learning now. There's a lot of other stuff that they were going to bring out.
The car had him nailed really good.
Yeah.
The cell phone data had him nailed really good. I mean, because again, he operated in such a stovepipe for someone that we're theorizing was planning on murdering people for such a long time. And we've said this before, people shouldn't. You know, what they're failing at is they're planning the murder and how to cover their tracks of the murder. They're not learning how to cover their tracks of the planning of the murder.
No. He's not this elusive enigma that I think.
He's not smart.
No, he's not. He's blinders completely. And that's what is his biggest downfall is.
He had dumb luck about cleaning up his mess of blood.
Mm-hmm. He was good at that. His OCD served him well there.
And that was
that's
it.
That's the only thing about, he did it. Good. Yeah.
He screwed up throwing his trash away. He screwed up.
His alibi. No alibi.
It was funny. Even the Facebook page, reading James Patterson's book about them kind of poking at who leaves a knife sheath behind? Who doesn't have it at least on their belt? I mean, how, like, would you carry a knife in the knife sheath? I mean, what the hell is it not doing on your belt? What? What?
Like, why is the sheath off of you?
Why is
like,
he off there?
Yeah.
And then his, and then Papa George's or Giorgio. Roger,
yeah. Papa Giorgio is Vegas Giorgio. Vacation.
I know.
Papa Giorgio.
And Papa Giorgio's car. Response was that, well, you're going to walk in there with a knife unsheathed? He wasn't even, he was so stupid, he wasn't even getting the point.
No, no.
Moron.
Jail records, this has been interesting to learn about what's been going on behind bars. Reporting he's obsessively washing his hands dozens of times a day, taking extended 45-minute showers. I didn't know you could take extended 45-minute showers in prison. Like,
and you might not want to do that after you might, a while.
It might not be a good thing. I think it'd be like, get in, get out. But he's doing that. There's also reports that he has a very bizarre sleeping schedule, more reminiscent of Dracula than a human being, yeah. Sleeping during the day, staying up at night, all night, and it very being it's disturbing to the other inmates because it's like, what the hell is this guy doing? Obviously, and also asking to speak to a priest immediately after being arrested. With some of these new things that we're learning about his behavior behind bars, what do you make of it as a behavioral expert?
I still think it's just a case of real broken brain.
Yeah.
And broken brain comes, you know, it's not just in him killing four kids, you know, it was broken in a lot of different ways. I think sleep schedules, his whole, just think about this. The thing that causes people to do things is massive chemical imbalances, and chemical imbalances in the brain are going to manifest in a lot of other areas, whether mm-hmm. it's sleep, melatonin production, and then seeing a priest. Remember, so the first thing that I thought of when you said see a priest is he's still seeking and needs stimulation of some sort, because that's the whole reason, I think, part of the reason why he wanted to kill someone is kind of get the stimulation that he wasn't getting. He was getting no emotional stimulation. He told his father about that early growing up. And so I think he's doing his best to try to keep doing something to trigger some sort of emotional response someplace in his brain. And maybe seeing a priest was going to be his way of doing it. It definitely ain't for repentance, because he doesn't give a rat's ass about that.
No, I'm like, how does religiousness play any role in his – unless it's a twisted brain. He very well could. He could.
Yeah, but also, you know, Rex Heuermann saw a priest too.
Yeah.
So, ugh.
I mean, it's self-serving. It's someone being able to tell you what you did is okay. And yeah. And you'll get forgiven for that.
So think about this. So what do priests do when they see you? They listen and validate you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what's his mother doing?
Yep.
There you go. So when he can't talk to his mommy, he's going to talk to a priest.
The only
Not because
people,
he's religious, yeah. But maybe someone will sit there and listen to him rant about how he is.
I'd like to pay a priest to go tell him he's going to burn in hell. Like, have the priest go and just like Olivia Gonzalez did. Like, I want it to be like that, where he thinks he's going to get a nice little like church time, and it's like the church lady like on crack. Bring Martin Short in there as the church lady. Like, you're going to hell.
Yeah, you know, it's sad we're laughing about it, but yeah. I think he just. It's because of the Gonsalveses. They really did a good job of helping us all deal with this. They really yeah. did, because they helped all of us go on offense with him in a much more profound way than I ever thought anyone could ever do that.
I've never,
because look what we're doing. We're laughing at him.
We are. I mean, and there you had. Yeah, I mean, it's so pathetic once you look, and once we're learning more and more about all this too, it's like, holy shit.
So think about how awesome this is and how those Gonsalves family did this. Had we only listened to the heart-wrenching, amazing, profound stories of the impact of the survivors, of the other roommates and all the family members, we'd be sitting here most likely talking about them, the people that were lost, the impact, and what a horrible human being he is. Meanwhile, we're riffing off of what the Gonsalveses gave us about what a pathetic human being he is. Yeah. And so it's enabled people like you and me and the rest of the world to poke fun at the piece of crap of a mm-hmm. human being that he is. And he's going to get nothing but that yeah. for the rest of his life. Good.
Yeah. I hope you found us on your iPad, Brian.
Yes. Wouldn't that be great? You suck.
Your time's coming. There's a lot of people that want to, you know, fill their
canteen.
Big
D's coming for you.
The Big D is on the way, bro.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.